It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. New research shows that MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, has a lot of potential to help heal severe cases of things like post-traumatic stress disorder. MDMA has been a popular party drug and a Schedule I controlled substance, the most restrictive level of drug control in the U.S. It has a history full of twists and turns, stretching back to 1912 and featuring use by therapists, ravers, and government agents trying to discover a truth serum during the Cold War. As with some other psychedelic drugs, scientists are discovering that MDMA has the potential to help address not just PTSD, but depression, addiction, existential anxiety faced by terminal patients, and more. In a new book, our next guest traces the past, present, and future of MDMA as a therapy and in recreational use. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used MDMA, and are you willing to share that story? What was your experience like with it? What do you want to know about how the drug works, its safety, or its potential to help PTSD and other mental health problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Neuer is a journalist and author. Her new book is I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
A lot of fascinating stories in your book. What led you, Rachel, to dig into this history of MDMA?
Oh, man, I just felt like the time was really ripe for MDMA to get its own story. You know, Michael Pollan really covered LSD and psilocybin in his book, How to Change Your Mind, a few years ago. But MDMA is a molecule with just as rich a history and a story in terms of politics, culture, science, and mental health.
Take us back to the invention of this drug in 1912, I think you write. And then it seems like people didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, the story really begins on Christmas Eve 1912, when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA, but they weren't actually looking for MDMA. It was just a chemical intermediary on a series of steps they were taking to get to a blood clotting agent. Merck denies that they ever realized that MDMA actually had psychoactive properties. That denial is a little questionable. But yeah, it popped up again in the 1950s during the U.S.'s search for a chemical truth serum, really unethical period in U.S. history when the CIA and the Army were doing tests on American citizens and Army soldiers. We don't actually know if MDMA was ever given to anybody. We haven't found that sort of smoking gun document to prove that the Army did give people MDMA. What we do know, though, is that it reemerged in 1975 in the Bay Area when a chemist resynthesized it and introduced it to the therapeutic community.
Before we dig more into the history, I want to talk a little bit about what the drug MDMA does. And a weird thing is, it depends. It seems like the experience might be very different if I'm sitting down for a therapy session with talk therapists and taking this versus I'm on a dance floor with 120 beats per minute electronic music going. Why is it so? What do we know about why it's so context dependent?
Yeah. Well, like most or all, in fact, psychedelic drugs, it's really about the set and the setting. So that refers to your mindset, what you're going into the experience, your mental baggage, your expectations, and the actual physical setting. So I have never done MDMA in a therapeutic context, but, you know, I've heard people who have say, you know, I don't know why they call this ecstasy. This is not an ecstatic experience. This is really difficult, hard, profound work. Whereas if you're just going in to have some light fun and dance all night with your friends, you're going to have a completely different experience. It is going to be euphoric. You're going to feel a deep sense of connection on the dance floor. You're probably going to have a really good time.
And your book shares a title with the great Donna Summer groundbreaking song, I Feel Love. And that is apparently a common, not a universal, but a common part of an experience using this drug.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, without knowing the title of my book, quite a few of my interview subjects use that exact phrase that, oh, you know, I felt love on this drug, or I even felt love for myself or for others for the first time in my entire life, in the case of some highly traumatized people.
Talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in with your questions. maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, you write that there was a period where we had people experimenting with MDMA as a therapy. Then it becomes outlawed effectively in 1985. Can you talk about that process that made it a Schedule I drug?
Yes. So therapists were introduced to MDMA quietly beginning in 1975, 1976, and it spread from the Bay Area out across the US and even to Europe. And they found that this was a really phenomenal tool that they could apply to pretty much any form of psychotherapy, whether it was couples therapy, helping people to process their trauma, or just helping people get more deeply in touch with themselves. But they knew that they needed to keep quiet about this new drug because they had seen what had happened to LSD a few years before. LSD in the 50s was given to some 40,000 patients around the world as a therapeutic aid, but then it was politicized, it was criminalized, it was outlawed. And they knew that if the US federal government caught wind of this new drug, the same fate would befall it. Well, lo and behold, that is what happened. The DEA caught wind of MDMA. They moved to schedule it, to put it on Schedule One, which is the most strictly banned substances with no current medical value, a high potential for abuse. The therapeutic community actually fought back against this. They put together a case, and they took the DEA to court. This was therapists, doctors, even Harvard professors arguing to the DEA that MDMA should in fact be a Schedule III drug, which would permit its use in medical context and also allow research to continue. They actually won that case. The administrative law judge sided with them and said, yes, MDMA should be Schedule III. But because it was an administrative case, the DEA only took that judgment as an opinion. And they just did, I guess, what they had planned to do all along, which was put MDMA on Schedule I, where it has remained ever since.
Things have loosened up some, you write. More people are able to do research. And I want to get into what seems to be the most advanced, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are therapists doing with MDMA for people with PTSD?
Yes. So this has been about a 20-year effort to test MDMA-assisted therapy's effectiveness for PTSD. It's just taken that long because of bureaucracy and also because researchers cannot easily get federal funding to test Schedule I substances. So that's why it's taken so long. But the results so far are really promising. The most recent phase 3 clinical trial, and this is 2 out of 3 necessary phase 3 trials before the drug can gain FDA approval. The results were very, very promising. About 2/3 of the 100 or so participants emerged after just 3 sessions of MDMA assisted therapy with no longer qualifying for a PTSD diagnosis. And these are people with severe cases of PTSD, with histories of suicidal ideation, with substance abuse disorders. They had PTSD for something like, 16 years on average. So these are really, really promising results that sort of blow out of the water any results we've seen from just talk therapy alone or traditional pharmaceuticals.
A lot of your book deals with the stories of people who have used MDMA for treatment. Can you share a little bit about the people you met who had been through PTSD treatment involving MDMA?
Oh, gosh, there were so many stories. And many of them were really emotional for me to hear. I heard from a veteran who had served in Vietnam and come back with really severe PTSD that he didn't recognize himself. And he lived with this crippling condition literally for decades until his wife was basically gave him an ultimatum and said, you have to get help for this or I can't stay with you. And after he did MDMA assisted therapy, he was finally able to recognize that deep, deep wound he had suffered as a result of what happened to him in Vietnam and begin to connect with himself, to forgive himself, and even to connect with his wife. He said that was the most beautiful thing that he got out of this. Now he's not afraid to talk to her and be honest with her about his feelings.
And I want to spell this out a little. This isn't, I get a prescription for an MDMA pill, I go home and I take it once a day or once a month or whatever. Can you talk through the process that people went through in this therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. That is such an important point. This isn't, here's your MDMA, go home and take it. And this also isn't, okay, well, we're going to meet here, you know, every week and take MDMA for the rest of your life. It's not a one and done process, but it's a lot closer to that model than something like traditional SSRIs or talk therapy would be. So you have a few sessions where you meet with a therapist, you talk about your issues, you talk about what you're hoping to get out of the actual medication session. Then on the day of, you meet with two therapists, ideally a man and a woman, and you put on blindfold, like eye shades, you put on headphones, you take the pill, you lie back on a couch or a bed, and you wait for the drug to take effect. Some people, once it does take effect, get really chatty. You know, they want to talk to their therapist. They want to process things out loud. Some people go deep into inside themselves and barely say a word the entire time. The whole thing takes about 7 or 8 hours. It's an entire day. For the clinical trials, at least, it was 3 sessions spaced a month apart. But in terms of the ideal number of sessions, that's something scientists and therapists are going to have to work out once this treatment is approved. You know, for some people, it could be fewer. For some people, it could be more.
We're talking to journalist and author Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one have experienced PTSD, would you be willing to try this MDMA-assisted therapy? Have you sought it out yourself? Do you think MDMA should be legalized for medicinal use, for recreational use? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist and author Rachel Neuer. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for a Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the latest research on the use of MDMA, that's often called ecstasy or Molly more recently, and other psychedelics to help with things like PTSD and other mental health conditions? Do you have experience with this particular drug yourself that you're willing to tell us about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, I want to talk about why this particular drug might help in this particular way. And some of the research is looking at the idea of a critical period in our brains. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so researchers have wondered for years why it is that something that is so short-acting like MDMA can have such profound lasting effects. And new neuroscience coming out of the lab of Gul Dolin at Johns Hopkins seems to perhaps provide an answer to that question. So under the set and setting of therapy, so when you go in prime to interact with your trauma and with a therapist's guidance, the brain seems to reopen what neuroscientists call a critical period. Critical periods are finite periods of malleability, usually that occur in childhood, when the brain is primed to learn new things, to make new connections, to set us up with the habits that will give us a lifetime of success out here in the world. It's why, for example, children can learn a new language so much easier than we adults can. What MDMA seems to do under that therapeutic guidance is reopen a social reward learning critical period. And this allows people to really reevaluate and reassess their trauma, the stories they've told themselves about their trauma, about themselves, the habits they formed around that trauma, if you think about typical PTSD symptoms. So you're literally rewiring your brain when you do MDMA-assisted therapy, which is what makes it so powerful if these results are indeed accurate.
What is the frontier of research on this now, trying to connect the dots between using something like MDMA in a therapy session and making these changes?
Yeah, I mean, there's very interesting research on the horizon. There's already been studies on using MDMA for severe social anxiety in autistic adults. There are studies going on in the UK now for MDMA's use for treating alcohol addiction. What I think is really interesting is if these critical period results hold up, then MDMA and actually other psychedelic drugs could be so-called master keys for reopening critical periods. And what that means is if you tune the set and setting, if instead of doing talk therapy, for example, you do occupational therapy, you could reopen a different critical period for motor learning. So at Johns Hopkins, they're now pursuing the idea of giving stroke patients MDMA and then giving them occupational therapy to see if they can regain much, much greater mobility than they would without the drug.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Okay, so I was in the military from the periods of 2001 to 2008, and I did two tours of combat while I was in, and stress has really taken a toll just kind of like on my mental health. And I've tried different therapies as far as, you know, talk therapy, and I couldn't connect with the people enough to feel comfortable enough sharing everything that I've been through. I have just recently been exposed to microdosing with psilocybin, but I haven't started yet or tried it. But how can somebody that, like myself, whose profession really hinders their ability to seek all therapies, try that. Try something different that might work.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this and haven't found a solution, at least not yet. But Rachel, Aaron's story sounds like a lot of the people you talked to in the book. And something he mentioned, he has a hard time being able to fully open up about his experiences in a talk therapy session. That's something you heard, I think, actually from veterans in your research.
Absolutely. Yeah, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing that story. And just know that you absolutely are not alone in these feelings. One of the beautiful things about MDMA-assisted therapy is the drug lowers activity in the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. So people don't feel just our natural reaction to keep things to ourselves, to protect ourselves, to present a certain image of ourselves to the world. We're better able to just be ourselves and be open. MDMA also increases feelings of connection with other people, which really helps in terms of the therapeutic process and kind of speeding the process of building trust with your therapists. As far as accessing MDMA under the context of your current job, unfortunately, it is still currently illegal. So you're going to have to wait if you want to do it legally until the FDA approves it. But hopefully that will happen by this time next year. And I should add too that there are now trials going on at VAs around the country. I have not heard of any in Wisconsin, but you can look those up. There's one in the Bronx. There's one in Oregon, in Texas.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. We are talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book, I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Back to your calls now. Ruthann is with us in Madison. Ruthann, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question, actually I have two of them, but I know that people experience PTSD for a variety of reasons, whether you're in the war, you could experience it from a bad car accident, also, you know, like from childhood traumas of every kind. So is there a type of PTSD that this works better for? I've not read your book, and maybe it's answered in there, but I'd like to read your book. I was also curious about how young or what's the ages that this can be used for other than adults, if so. So those are my questions.
Ruthann, thanks for the call. Rachel, you did talk to people who experienced different causes of PTSD. Your thoughts for Ruthann?
Yeah, both excellent questions. So the clinical trials involved not just veterans, but people with all forms of PTSD from childhood, from sexual assault, first responders, from natural disasters, things like that. And the results held up across the board. This seems to be an effective treatment regardless of the source of your PTSD. So that's great news. In terms of, what was the second part of that question?
Could you remind young me? Can people, being in
Thank
trials
you.
For? Yeah.
So these trials were for adults, but actually the FDA, if they approve MDMA-assisted therapy, there is a requirement that adolescents then have to go through clinical trials as well. So this could wind up being a treatment that can be given to adolescents as well, but we're going to have to await those safety and efficacy results.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, I should ask, people might be listening thinking, hey, this is a Schedule I controlled substance. Aren't there risks? Are there harms? What do we know?
Yeah, definitely. MDMA, like anything, you know, like water, like aspirin, can be unsafe and even deadly if you take too much of it or you take it under the wrong circumstances. In a therapist's office, there have been no serious side effects or emergencies or anything like that. However, if you do take it out in the world illegally, you run the risk of taking tainted drugs because, again, you're having to buy the drug illegally. You don't know what you're getting unless you test it yourself. You also run the risk of accidentally taking too much MDMA and overdosing yourself if you're not testing the drugs for the percentage content and then weighing out an appropriate sample. The two things that tend to occur most often in terms of emergencies and even deaths from MDMA are overheating. So you're dancing all night, you're not drinking water, you're not taking breaks, and you perhaps took too much MDMA. And also some people wind up drinking too much water, and MDMA causes the body to retain water. So if you start chugging gallons of water, you can cause something called the name escapes me, but it lowers your sodium levels in your blood, which can cause your brain cells to swell, and that can be deadly. So hyponatremia, that is the name.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Neuer, journalist and author. She talked to us about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, growing up in the Midwest, I remember learning the history of the region something like this. There were Native Americans here before European settlers came, but then American and European immigrants came in the 1800s and settled a mostly empty, unpopulated wilderness. If you look at maps of the history of the region, you can see Wisconsin as a French possession, then a British territory, then part of the newly created United States, even though the indigenous population was larger than the European population until well into the 1800s. Our next guest says there's a huge story hidden by commonly held views of history, of efforts to expand the boundaries of American statehood by taking land from Native Americans, and of resistance to those efforts by the indigenous people of Wisconsin and the wider Midwest. In his new book, he tells the story of treaties made and violated, land stolen and sold, and the Native leaders, U.S. government officials, and others in the middle of the story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about indigenous tribes and the colonization of Wisconsin? What do you remember learning about that period in history? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Witkin is a professor in the Department of History and the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. His latest book is called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. It was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this effort that's at the heart, I think, of your book, correcting this gap that I certainly grew up with in my understanding of the history of our region?
Yeah, I think the way you phrased it here at the beginning, that thinking about the history of Wisconsin, or at least the non-native history, as a colonial history, as a history of this colonization of Wisconsin. I think that's kind of new to most people. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to recover, that this wasn't a state or a continent that was sort of empty and settled by pioneers who tamed a wilderness, but rather it was an indigenous continent, and its settlement by non-native people was an act of colonization.
The idea from even before the United States became a country that was at the heart of this seems to be, okay, we define use of land in this way. A person holds title to this piece of land and improves it. And Native Americans aren't doing that, not in the way we'd expect. That, therefore, that gives us, the English, and then the Americans, the right to take that land. That seems to be at the heart of so much of westward expansion, including here in what was the Northwest Territory.
Absolutely. I mean, so this is the sort of idea of discovery, or sometimes called the doctrine of discovery. And this is the idea that when Europeans arrive in the Americas, and in North America in particular, that they found a new world, and that new world was, for all intents and purposes, uninhabited because it didn't have sort of recognizable forms of property or private property like you would have in Western Europe. And with that as a sort of framework, the original colonial project allowed monarchs from Europe to say, I've discovered this land, it's unsettled, and therefore I can claim it by right of discovery. The right of discovery becomes a way in which they grant the crown charters to colonies in the Eastern Seaboard. There's the Seven Years' War where the two competing empires, France and Great Britain, compete with one another. France loses, they cede their claims to North America to the British. And following the Revolution, at the settlement of that war, the British Empire cedes huge swaths of North America to the United States, all through this idea about a right of discovery, that they were essentially passing land that had been claimed because it was unsettled by kings, claimed as a possession, incorporated into empire, and then transferred to the Republic. And so the Republic basically takes up that same ideological project, the idea that the territory in the west of the Appalachian Mountains that had been granted to it by the Treaty of Paris that ends the Revolution is unsettled land, and the U.S. sets out to kind of settle that. And the story of Wisconsin is totally wrapped up in that process, the settlement where the United States has to come to grips with the fact that the land is not empty, that it's occupied by Native people, and that settling isn't just a matter of moving settlers onto a forest and changing it, but rather engaging with Native people and then actively sort of working to colonize them and their land.
We operated under this Northwest Ordinance here in the Northwest Territory that included Wisconsin. Can you talk about what that was and how it set the stage for how that land would be taken and then distributed?
Sure. So the Northwest Ordinance is the way by which the United States figures out what to do with it. When we come out of the Revolution, all this land really from the Appalachian Mountains out to the Mississippi, the United States regards as part of its public domain. It's the land that I mentioned had been transferred by the Great Britain to the United States. It's not settled by Americans, therefore they consider it public land that's controlled by the federal government. And they decide the way to settle that orderly with the Northwest Ordinance, which is a land law. And the ordinance is a way that you can both organize territory, and that will eventually become a state, and then also sell the land within that territory. And the way the Northwest Ordinance works is that when you get 5,000 free white men, that's enough to organize a space as a territory, so the territory of Michigan or the territory of Indiana. Once the territory is organized, the progression goes from 5,000 free white men to 60,000 free white settlers. When you've reached the 60,000 population mark, the territory can petition the federal government to enter the Union as a state with its own constitution, and then it enters the Union as a state with all the rights and privileges that other states. And so that's the model that's used in order to create territories, turn the Northwest Territory into specific territories, the states that are now Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota were all part of the original Northwest Territory. And for the most part, in the southern tier of the Northwest Territories, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, they fill up really fast, and they reach the requisite population of 60,000 persons to become states and enter the Union all within the early 1800s. Ohio is a state in 1803. Illinois and Indiana, I think, are 1808 and 1818, respectively, have become states in the Union. And it's in part because those territories are all connected to the Ohio River, to the Mississippi, and the Mississippi connects that territory to the sort of larger market economy of the U.S., New Orleans, St. Louis, And so it makes sense if you want to be a farmer in Ohio or in Illinois, you can get your product to a market than a U.S. market. But above the Ohio River, what would now be, say, Michigan and Ohio territory, it makes a lot less sense to settle. And so those territories actually remain territories for a long time. Michigan territory, which is formed in 1805, actually stays a territory, doesn't get the 60,000 population threshold until 1837. And Wisconsin isn't even organized as a territory until 1837. Before that time, it's part of Michigan. And as late as 1820, the Michigan territory, which would have been Michigan now, plus Wisconsin, plus Minnesota, had less than 20,000 non-native settlers. And that's, you know, going into 1820. So that's really late. It's not till the Erie Canal is completed and opens in 1826 that it begins to make sense to start moving into these more northern parts of the Northwest Territory, because only then can you start getting things like agricultural products or timber out to a market in the U.S.
Talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. Michael, a huge part of the story you tell is of how natives in Wisconsin and beyond reacted to this drive to populate the states with settlers from out east. What were some of the key points in the story you researched?
There's several key points. There's an important treaty in 1837 that cedes a huge swath of Wisconsin, now is Wisconsin, I think something around the nature of 11 million acres. And it's a treaty that the indigenous peoples tell American officials they don't want to cede. And there's not a lot of population pressure in 1837 for that northern Wisconsin territory. But the U.S. basically tells the native people that they have to cede it or it'll be taken from them. And so they do. And they are compensated something about, I think, in the nature of around 13 cents per acre, which the U.S. can then turn around and sell through the Northwest Ordinance for $1 an acre, so making an enormous amount of profit. And then that property often enters into circulation in private becomes private property of individuals who sit on it and don't necessarily develop it right away, and maybe sit on it for 10 or 15 years where it can sell for, say, $80 an acre. So you have this sort of massive transfer of land and wealth from native people to the federal government, and then the transfer of that federal government, that land as a public domain to the individual settlers in the United States, basically at a subsidized way of settling the settlement, because you can sell that land at a way below market rate because the government has a monopoly when they acquire it from native people. So it's a process where you're sort of facilitating the colonization by creating a sort of a monopoly on land sales and then making that land available in a really affordable manner to most people in order to encourage immigration.
And that's at the heart of the idea of plunder you introduce, actually, even in the subtitle of your book. Can you talk about the scope of financial benefit to the United States, individuals, and to the federal government of that sort of forced appropriation of land and then distribution of it?
This was one of the things that really was a surprise for me. And if you think about the United States and the histories we all get in elementary school and junior high school and high school, these standard kind of survey histories, when you get to the early Republic, where you tend to find Indians in that history in a standard survey is with the Trail of Tears, the really tragic removal of Native peoples from what would then be the Southeast. You can think places like Georgia, North Carolina, the Alabama, Mississippi, the Trail of Tears. That's pretty common. And that makes sense with the story. There's a hunger for land. Indians are facing pressure. They're removed. You don't have that in the Northwest Territories. I mean, to some extent, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, as I said, fill up really quick. But the land in territories like Michigan and Wisconsin, there's just less demand for it. And because there's less demand for it, the federal government sort of needs to entice people to move in. And what ends up happening is, rather than having a pressure to remove Indians, people in states like Michigan and Wisconsin quickly discover that having Indians in place, this sort of colonized subject, is way more lucrative than kicking them off and taking over their land. And I say it's more lucrative because the treaty process, this treaty process where federal representatives of the federal government come in, negotiate with tribal members, often through people that are traders or Indian agents. And most of the traders and Indian agents are intermarried with the tribe, so they have indigenous wives and children. And they negotiate these treaties to cede land in exchange for a payment of money. I mentioned that before with the 1837 treaty. So you get a $20,000 cash payment for 10 years for the sale of this 13 million acres. But when that payment is made, and the federal officials would show up with specie, with actual currency, which is often rare in early 19th century America, that payout usually went something in the neighborhood of 90% or more to traders or merchants who would claim that Native peoples owed them debt from the fur trade, and debt that hadn't been repaid. And so each of these payments that were coming in to compensate Native people for the sale of land by a forced treaty, the money for that would mostly not end up in Native hands. It would mostly end up in the hands of merchants, traders, agents, people who were engaged in this fur trade. They would take that money and invest in their business, develop it in that way. The same merchants who were claiming that that money is debt would also be hired out by the government. Part of the payment was a cash payment in compensation for the land cession, but part of it was, say, $10,000 in provisions and goods. The federal government would buy those from the same merchants who were claiming it as debt. So they're making money by claiming the cash as debt. They're making money by covering the provisions that are also part of the annual payment for land sales by providing that to the federal government. So basically, you've got the sort of the leaders of the Wisconsin Territory, the Michigan Territory, often people who are connected with the fur trade, that history, helping it transition out of the fur trade and out of the Indian era by facilitating these land transfers, which bring tons of cash into the state or territory, cash that they then themselves can claim. So there's a lot of money to be made in not removing the Indians like you do in, say, Georgia or Alabama, but keeping them in place and negotiating treaty after treaty, which brings cash in, which you can then claim. So that cash becomes a way in which people basically develop the infrastructure of their businesses and the state economy. And it's a way of basically not just taking land, but really taking the wealth and land together, kind of plundering the resources of the indigenous population in order to sort of economically develop the state and territory.
Talking to Columbia University History Professor Michael Witkin about the book Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. In his work, he focuses a lot on Wisconsin and the surrounding region. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about his research and Native history in Wisconsin, the history of U.S. settlement in the region? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Michael Witkin about his book, Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. Yep, go for it.
Well, this is living history, and it's very exciting to share with you that last year in 2022, we transferred land from the city of Superior, the Diocese of Superior, and the Douglas County back to the Fond du Lac tribe. First time they've owned land in Wisconsin, I think, since the Treaty of 1857. So under the right leadership, you can right some wrongs from the past, and it's an exciting time to remember that, 170 years later or something.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael, you are definitely thinking about this history you write about in the present day. What kind of things are you watching for with current land issues related to the descendants of the people you write about?
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I'm interested in those sort of land back sort of movements. A lot of the land in northern Wisconsin in northern Michigan, the UP, is ceded when there really isn't demand for it. There's maybe some demand for mining, some demand for timbering, but a lot of that land has then passed into sometimes public trust for counties or universities or other things. Sometimes it's passed into it was privately owned, but now it's owned. It's public land, and that restoring that kind of land, that's really fascinating to hear that kind of history. I've been interested in that. I think it's also quite interesting that a lot of the land that comes out of these treaties that I mentioned makes its way into the financial instruments that are used to create the land grant colleges in the United States, the Morrill Act, which mandated the creation of a land grant university in all the states in the Union, which is a university that focuses on agricultural training. Those universities are all funded through the Morrill Act, which used basically land that had been ceded by the tribes in the United States that have been turned into financial instruments like a bond and then sold or given back to the states, and the states then cash those land scripts in order to fund the endowments for the land grant universities. Huge amounts of the territory that had been ceded in the 1837 treaty makes its way into the public domain that's then used for funding land grant universities. So, I mean, it's part of the public infrastructure of the United States comes from this transfer of land. And I think reckoning with that and coming to grips with it and finding things like in Superior where you can maybe give the land back if it's possible is a really interesting sort of recognition of this colonial history and sort of undoing some of the legacies of it.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Michael, I don't want to miss something in your book. It isn't all big picture stuff. You share real people and their stories. One amazing story was leaders from the St. Croix Band of Ojibwe journeying against the advice of federal officials to negotiate directly with President Millard Fillmore in 1852 with some consequences. Can you briefly share that story?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it was one of my distant relatives was on that trip, and it was a moment where when the treaties had been signed in Wisconsin, one of the provisions that leaders were making was that we won't be removed. And they were saying this is, the era of removal. And they said, well, sign the treaties if you're going to force us, but we want to remain on our land. And so that treaty had been made in 1854. The U.S. government was making plans to go back and remove tribes from northern Wisconsin. And they got wind of it. Some leaders did, as you mentioned, and they sort of snuck off the reservation, made their way to Washington, D.C., and were able to secure an audience with the president and get his commitment to not remove them, to let them stay on their homelands. And so it's a kind of an amazing example of Ojibwe people fighting to remain in their homeland, taking whatever they could in order to preserve that homeland, the territory, that connection to that landscape. And in this case, the journey was kind of amazing. They got stopped in Detroit. The Indian Nation let them go on. They ran out of money in New York. They actually staged a dinner in a New York hotel where they invited people to come in and dine with the Ojibwe chiefs from Lake Superior to fund the rest of the trip to make it to D.C. So it was quite an amazing escapade in the 19th century where Indians were sort of popular cultural figures, but they're also sort of real people fighting to maintain their homeland. And that's part of the story of why Native people in Wisconsin don't get removed. They fought and resisted to stay in their homeland. And I would put a final note, a lot of they brought with them letters from a lot of the towns in Wisconsin on the Superior shoreline who were telling federal government they wanted, in fact, Indians to stay, because they also recognized this political economy of plunder that I was mentioning. And they said, Indians are good neighbors, and so we don't want them removed. So they traveled with letters from non-Native peoples in Wisconsin who were also asking, along with the Ojibwe, to not let them be removed to Indian territory. Pretty amazing story.
Time for one more caller. Nancy is with us in Winneconne. Nancy, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, a few months ago, and there are some historical markers around the city, and they indicated that they were Potawatomi who lived in that area, and they were forced to go west. I don't remember exactly where they had to go, but I recall that they had to leave.
Nancy, thanks for the call. And Michael, do you want to see wider efforts to share the history that you recount in your book, whether it's that public sign or other venues?
Absolutely. I think people don't realize the extent to which the history, particularly the Midwest, is an indigenous history. And American history is really intertwined with indigenous history in a way that can't be separated. So thinking about that is really important. I think thinking about the way that our public lands get created or public universities get created off this kind of colonial relationship is super important. Helping people realize that there's a connection with Native people have to land that still exists today, that's historic, that precedes America is really important when people see tribes exercising treaty rights, those sorts of things. So I'm all for getting this sort of message, this history out.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Michael Witkin, professor in the Department of History and the Center for Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. He's a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He was with us today to share his latest book. It's called Seeing Red, Indigenous Land, American Expansion, and the Political Economy of Plunder in North America. That was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist this year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, stream live at WPR.org or check out our extremely extensive archives there. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how to encounter the unexpected in familiar places. Go for a walk with some psychogeography. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about an app that helps users practice the Hmong language.
In the late 2000s, Apple popularized the phrase, "There's an app for that," highlighting the abundance of apps available for the iPhone. But when Annie Vang of Madison got into app development around the same time, she didn't see programs made in the Hmong language. Producer Hope Kerwin has more on the app she built and the way it's keeping native speakers and beginners connected to the language.
Eau Claire resident Tiffany Moore grew up speaking Hmong with her family, but as she got older, she started to lose some of her vocabulary and found herself struggling to remember words she didn't use frequently.
You know, you go to school, you speak English only. I didn't have any classes where they taught you in Hmong, so my Hmong language wasn't utilized as much as I had wanted to.
Moa was scrolling through Facebook one day when she saw a post about an iPhone app called Hmong Phrases. The app allows users to look up words and common phrases and hear an audio recording of how they're pronounced. Moa says she immediately downloaded it, hoping to test out her memory and her grammar.
When you grow up and you don't really speak fluent Hmong, you kind of create your own little sentences and you just formulate your own way of saying things, and it's not always correct. One that I do remember looking for was, "Can I pay for this?" Even now, like if I were to go shopping at like an Oriental store, I wouldn't know how to formulate this sentence properly.
The Hmong Phrases app was created by fellow Wisconsinite Annie Vang, who it turns out is also Moa's aunt. Vang is an iOS app developer from Madison, and she built the program 11 years ago after taking an app development course at Madison Area Technical College. Vang says she was inspired by advice from her professor, who encouraged her to build something she was passionate about.
Google Translate didn't exist at that time, and the Hmong language definitely was not in Rosetta Stone or any of the other language apps that were out there in the App Store. And so I took it upon myself that, you know, I want people to know who we are, who I am, and I felt that it was important to just, you know, have a presence in the App Store and leave a digital footprint of it.
11 years, constant updates, and one major rewrite later, the app now has over 4,000 downloads. Vang says she's always looking for ways to improve the program, taking feedback directly from users and from her parents, who are her primary beta testers. She says there have been some surprising requests from users about what they'd like to see added. She's been asked for more medical terms and Hmong names from people hoping to use them for babies.
They're interested in, like, how do you say a baby name? What does it mean? How do you pronounce it? And I thought it was kind of cool. So that's a feature that I'm currently building it right now, because we're such an oral language that if you just read the word, the name, you may not know how to pronounce it.
Beyond learning words and phrases, Vang says the app also allows native Hmong speakers to practice their intonation, an important part of the mostly oral language. She says young Hmong Americans often speak Hmong stiffly or struggle to hit the right tonal marks.
I can hear that a lot in the kids that are going up there are not speaking it like fluently with maybe an elder. Even my nieces and nephews do the same thing, where when they say they're hungry, they're saying it like it doesn't have the right tone markers. And so you can understand what they're saying, but they may not know that they're saying it more English than Hmong.
This is something that niece and app user Moa says she appreciates about the program. Growing up, Moa says she spoke both English and Hmong to her parents, or sometimes a combination of the two, which she and other speakers call Hmonglish.
My parents knew enough of what I was trying to say that in the spot, because they understood it, they didn't say, "Oh no, you're saying that wrong." They'll just answer you.
Moa says she's not sure she'll ever fully master the Hmong language, but she's motivated to keep practicing so she can one day pass it on to her children and maintain the connection to her native language.
WPR's Hope Kerwin brought us that story about an app for the Hmong language. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is Central Time. Now, how well do you know your local landscape, your neighborhood, your community, your local park? For a lot of us, we really only experience a small portion of the place we live, on the paths we travel the most, the roads to and from work, the store, and so on. But we can get something more out of that local landscape with a change of our mindset. That's one goal of something called psychogeography. It's a fancy word. It means, in practice, walking and exploring in a way that's intentionally unintentional. Our next guest is a Wisconsin artist who uses psychogeography as an inspiration for his art, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite place to go for a regular walk? When you walk, do you have to have a destination in mind, or do you just start wandering? And do you find ways to connect, to observe the places you walk around? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Jeremy Weinberg is a designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. Jeremy, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, tell us more about this concept of psychogeography. What is it?
I kind of think of it like the practice of mapping your thoughts out onto the environment, and then at the same time having the environment mapped onto your thoughts. So it's sort of a two-way street where you're bringing what you have going on internally to bear on the environment, but you're also allowing the environment to directly impact what's going on internally.
And what's some of the history of this idea?
Well, I think the term comes from the Situationist International and a particular person named Guy Debord. But the practice of it and the techniques that it uses have been going on for a long time before that. I think for the Situationists International, it was a way of subverting things like the way that the city was planned out for you to get from point A to point B, and wandering or allowing yourself to drift was a way of getting around how people want you to move through the city. So it was almost like a form of protest for them. But earlier, I think and this is the part that I felt the most drawn to, was the surrealists, who really saw the city as this place of mystery that you dive into and explore and unravel and come up with interesting ways to make work, make connections that you wouldn't have necessarily made before, to meet interesting people, and to get a level of detail from your surroundings that you don't normally get when you're just kind of stumbling around on your way to work or to the market or what have you.
In just a bit, I want to talk about how this inspires your art. But for people at home who are thinking, okay, this sounds kind of cool, I want to give it a try. You mentioned there are kind of methods, not rules exactly, but psychogeography methods that we can use. If somebody wants to go for that walk, maybe in their own neighborhood, their community, how can they get started on this?
Well, it's really about sort of leading with your nose, paying attention to what is in front of you and allowing things that you're seeing to act as clues, to cultivate a sense of curiosity, to create a direction or a movement. There's actually this really great quote that I've used when I taught projects that deal with it from an artist named Robert McFarlane. I can read it because
sure.
He just says it so wonderfully that I don't know that I can
go for it. Yeah,
really do too much more in explaining it. But he begins by saying psychogeography, a beginner's guide. Unfold a street map of London. Place a glass rim down anywhere on the map and draw around its edge. Pick up the map. Go out into the city and walk the circle, keeping as close as you can to the curve. Record the experience as you go in whatever medium you favor: film, photograph, transcript, manuscript, tape. Catch the textural runoff of the streets, the graffiti, the branded litter, the snatches of conversation. cut for sign, log the data stream, be alert to happenstances of metaphors, watch for visual rhymes, coincidences, analogies, family resemblances, the changing moods of the street. Complete the circle and the record ends. Walking makes for content, footage for footage.
Now, I think I'm better at getting into that kind of mindset and doing that kind of random walk when I go to a new place. I'm really bad at it close to home, which seems like possibly like a place that would be really ripe for that kind of cool, innovative discovery.
Yeah, I think it works in either way. For me, it's a way to explore a new area and dive deep into it and become familiar with it. But it's also a way to explore familiar areas and to make them new again, to see them differently. And there's all sorts of techniques that people have come up with to sort of do this on familiar territory. One of the surrealist techniques that I think is great is take a map of another city and use it to navigate the city that you're in. So it's a way of sort of making you go or move through something that you're used to moving through in a very different way, and using that as a way to create the stimulus that you don't normally get when you move through that environment. So it's maybe a little different tact when you're familiar with it, because you have to do something to make it different, and to be able to sort of separate you from the everyday mindset that you're used to moving it through, to get into, to be able to see it differently.
We're talking with Wisconsin-based artist and educator Jeremy Weinberg about the creative and emotional benefits of wandering and exploring our familiar environments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this, these kind of random walks, looking at things in a new way, maybe in your own community, or in the early days of COVID, when there wasn't a lot better to do than go for a walk? Did you find new and interesting ways, turning a different way on that street you turn left instead of right like you usually would? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Jeremy Weinberg, a Wisconsin-based artist and educator, about the idea of psychogeography, walking and exploring our environments by following our minds, not our schedules, finding different ways to look at familiar territory, getting inspiration by doing so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an artist, have you found inspiration just by walking around? Have you trained yourself in some ways to seek out some artistic inspiration from a familiar environment? If you like to go for a lot of walks, do you shake things up, break the routine, find random ways to appreciate that local walk? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeremy, a lot of your art is inspired by this psychogeographical mindset. Can you give us a couple examples of what's come out of that?
Sure. The last piece, I think, that I spent a lot of time in that sort of state of mind at, had to do with Lake Winnebago. And my mother-in-law has a house on Lake Winnebago, so we spend a lot of time there and have been going there repeatedly over the last, since I've been in Wisconsin, so like the last 15 years. And I wanted to make a piece that dealt with this particular place, but I wanted to bring in some other viewpoints. So I asked people that went to school there, that lived there, for some video documents or photo documents that they might have taken of the place that have stood out to them. And then I sort of threw those together with some of my own video documents that I'd taken over the years, and created this video installation where a lot of these points of view were kind of mixed up and projected in a space that was at the University of Oshkosh, which is in University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, sure, at the Alan Preeb Gallery. And that was last fall. So the thing I think that that really made it interesting to me was that all of the projections that were happening in the room were bounced around by a lot of reflective material that was also hanging in the room. So it's sort of hard to describe, but essentially you're walking into a space that's located nearby the lake shore, and you're having images of the lake sort of bouncing all around you. So for people that live on the lake or by the lake or have to deal with things that are particular to Lake Winnebago, like the lake flies and things like that, it was a different way to experience it from how they're used to doing. So my hope was that, you know, people would be able to sort of come out of it seeing things a little differently than they're used to. So that's one of them. I have a few other projects too that about other places that I've been interested in, but a lot of them are relatively local.
And do you have kind of eureka moments? You're out there, you're walking, you're trying to do this sort of psychogeography type observation. How do things like sort of gradually build up, or do you have aha moments where you're like, aha, I could do this inspired by this part of the environment?
I think really for me, what I have are the like thousand little aesthetic moments that I do the best I can to document, either by taking a video or a photo or by doing a drawing or just like trying to make a memory that stays around long enough that I can, you know, somehow work it in. But for me, it's an aesthetic experience that usually is what draws my attention. You know, one of the things I remember particularly after moving here and doing walks like this that I wasn't prepared for was stumbling across some of the Native American effigy mounds and not knowing anything about that because I grew up in another part of the country. So to me, that was just mind blowing that there are these things that I stumbled across that, you know, were from thousands of years ago that cultures that had nothing to do with the city built, and here they are in this particular neighborhood.
Even if we're not going to make art based on our observations, I've seen people make a case for the benefits, our emotional well-being, our connection to our surroundings. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that allows you to do is just like read a level of complexity into a place, almost like the kind of complexity that you might like read into another person that you meet. You get a sense of a particular mood of a place, and you can sort of have a conversation with it by just looking at the way, you know, the plants are growing around each other, looking at how, like, you know, there may be paths that have been worn into a particular park where people go off of the walkways and make their own walkways and what happens there, and following those and seeing where they go instead, or finding traces of animals or people's dogs or discarded clothing that might have been left somewhere that, you know, there's got to be some kind of story behind. So for me, like, this is all like it's just a deeper experience of a place. And for places that you're visiting regularly, I feel like it's like getting to know an elder or somebody that you know, has been around for a long time, and realizing that there's a depth to their experiences and that you can learn a lot from them.
Yeah, and the time element, the Lake Winnebago thing you mentioned, getting older pictures and images from there, and just the idea of going to the same place again and again and seeing how it can change, maybe just through the seasons, adds a lot of depth.
Yeah, and so like one place that I feel like I like to haunt is in Madison. It's a park in the Vilas neighborhood, Bear Mound Park, which is the first place that I stumbled on an effigy mound. But there's also these beautiful old oak trees there. And going there different times of years, you see different things. There's not only the leaves changing, but I've seen, you know, all of these milkweed pods like open up and mm-hmm. create these like flows of all this white fluffy material that just, when you sort of put yourself in like an insect point of view, moving through all of that, it's like being in a whole nother world. But it's just this little, you know, one block circle. But inside of that circle, there's just this whole microcosm of not only like all these natural things, but this like level of cultural history that goes back like thousands of years. To me, it's just a fascinating place.
And just our last half a minute or so, leave us with some inspiration for somebody who says, yeah, I want to try this. One quick thing they might do after they turn off the radio.
So I think just going out and spinning yourself around and opening your eyes up and following that first thing that you see is a good way to start. You know, if you have the opportunity to go someplace new, I feel like it's a little bit easier because everything is kind of something to jump into. But there's always new things around you if you just try to shift your perspective a little bit and see it from a different angle.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Jeremy Weinberg, designer, educator, and visual artist based in Madison. He joined us to talk about the art of psychogeography, finding inspiration by wandering and exploring around the places we live and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.